Let's go. Here we go now.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, where we explore purpose as a part of who we already are. We showcase all inspiring stories of the most purpose-driven people on the planet with the intention of giving you the tools to step into the potential of who you were always born to be. After all, it's in your DNA. Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. I have to say that today I am so excited to be introducing to you all an incredible thought leader, business influencer, and one of the nicest humans in the world of speaking that I have had the pleasure of working with. His name is Phil Nosworthy, and he is an executive advisor, speaker, and writer in the subject areas of meaning, leadership, and high performance. Trust me, today's conversation is a big one. We went deep into the layers of purpose, meaning, the convergence of skills required to thrive as leaders in an age of uncertainty, and we even threw in a splash of Jungian psychology at the end for a bit of fun. However, before we get started today, a quick reminder that I will be hosting a free webinar especially for you on the 24th of February, designed to assist you in unlocking your DNA of purpose. The DNA of purpose is a process that draws on scientific thinking to provide a framework for an individual to align more deeply with their life purpose. A purpose that is less focused on a statement of why and more focused on who we are in the world. It addresses how we show up in every interaction in a purposeful way by simply living in our truth. So if you would like to register, you can find the link in the show notes. So without further delay, let's welcome Mr. Phil Nosworthy to the DNA of Purpose podcast.
Oh, no, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
So look, as I was just saying before we started recording, I am so excited to unleash your wisdom for the DNA of Purpose audience today. So with that in mind, I'd love to take a moment for you to share with our listeners who you are, what you do, and how what you do creates meaning in your life.
Oh man, it's a big question, huh? So what do I do? I think I read things, I talk about things, I hang out with people, and it takes the form of leadership and learning. And that is all about high performance. It's about helping people make sense of work and, most importantly, make sense of work in the context of their life and who they want to be. You know this more than most people, that there's so often a disjunction, you know, a break between how people are showing up to life, what it is that they want from life, and what they do with the vast majority of their time. So we help people synthesize that. And usually that kind of runs under the banner of skill and substance. We want people to be good at what they do, but mostly we want people to understand the role that character and substance plays in being able to unleash their skill and talent. I think everybody who's listening into this has met their fair share of people who are skillful enough. They've got a wall full of certificates and maybe they've been in their game, you know, for 10 or 15 years, maybe even longer, but they're not very pleasant to be about. You could be the most skillful person in the room, but if it's not married with and amplified by the substance of who you are, it just won't take you very far. So that's the kind of work we do. We're very privileged to do it with who we do it with. We work with teams, mostly global teams, at a very large level. Organizations like Microsoft, GitHub, Universal Music. We do work with the AFL, all of AFL's leadership programming here in Australia, GitHub, Boston Consulting Group. So our MO is about impact and helping people make impact for themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, for all of these reasons, I have been really excited to talk to you. And really, at the heart of that is that everything that you stand for is about the DNA of purpose. It's about really being everything that we were born to be at home, but also at work, and especially in leadership, where, you know, our ability to influence really starts from the inside out.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other way to do it. I think people, I mean, this is a go-to line, but it doesn't make it less honest and real for me, is that people either earn or forfeit the right or the role or the opportunity to lead others based on the way that they're leading themselves. And a lot of people have aspirations for leadership. I really like that. I love the fact that people want to be a leader, but there's a big difference between having role-based or hierarchy-based leadership and being a leader of people. The desire to be a leader of people is the one that I'm most interested in. For the people who have a heart for others, who want to bring the best out in others, who want to create change, who want to, all of those good things, that's who we want to work with. And yeah, the way that you've said that, which is this huge and beautiful connection between who you are as a person and the way that you show up to work, that's the thing that's got to be investigated mostly. Because again, at risk of just sounding like a broken record, we either earn the right or we forfeit the right to lead others based on the way that we're leading ourselves.
So, Phil, I want to hear all about, you know, your professional perspectives. But before I do that, I actually want to step back in time for a moment. I mentioned to you I did some friendly stalking yesterday, and I actually came across a beautiful article online featuring some of your personal perspectives on the creation of a meaningful life. And in the article, at least in my opinion, you question the idea that we have to have this overarching life purpose, and that regardless of what we do or where we apply meaning in our lives, the focus is found in being purposeful in the present moment, in any given moment or in any context. Why do you think as human beings we've got caught up in the idea that that purpose is kind of like searching for the holy grail rather than seeing it as a moment by moment decision to intentionally create meaning?
I have a take on that. But it might be confronting for certain people, but I'm going to share it nonetheless, because I think that's that. the point of conversations like this, which is, I think it's just a hangover from certain monotheistic approaches to life. And when I say monotheistic, like religious worldviews that kind of frame purpose up as something that is given to you by something or someone else. And I've heard it described as, if a chair has a purpose, if a spoon has a purpose, then you have a purpose. And I think it's easy for people to go, oh, cool. Well, that's a relief, because that means I don't have to work it out for myself. It also means that maybe it's more simple because it's just one thing. And so over a long period of time, the last 2000 years has seen the dominance of monotheistic worldviews. But I think we're also understanding, and as Eastern literature and as Eastern mythology and as Eastern influence really comes more and more deep into the West and influences the way that we show up just as everyday people, but let alone business, we're starting to recognize that purpose is also a fluid thing. And the purpose of my life as a 15-year-old should be different than the purpose of my life as a 25-year-old. I don't mind if some people want to identify an overarching theme, that there's this one quest, because who am I to define what somebody else's purpose is for them? But I do know that that's created a lot of challenges for some because of the angst that is, what if I get it wrong? Or what if I pick this thing, but my purpose was something else, as though that was even possible. And so what I found is that purpose is the thing that's in front of us. And that for me, say, for instance, right now, I have an incredible 4.5-year-old daughter. I have an incredible 9-month-old son. That's a part of my purpose. But truth be told, there's also going to be a time in my life when my daughter falls in love and goes on her own adventures and steps into her own autonomy and the fullness of who she is to be. If I kept a hold of her as though the purpose in, say, let's call it like 15 years is the same as the way that I care and nurture for her now, I'm going to be in trouble and she's going to be in trouble. So we have to hold this concept of purpose, not loosely. We have to be deeply committed to it, but we have to keep checking in on it, because it's going to evolve as much and as often as we do.
Look, I love your take on this. And I've always believed at least in my own perception of purpose as I've experienced, that it's an energy in motion. And because of that, it exists in the present moment. And our role in being purposeful is actually getting out of the way of that flow and dealing with anything that blocks that alignment, which sort of taps back into what we were talking before about our ability in life to influence ourselves. And that if we want to become more aware and more tuned in with the energy of purpose, whether that be as a parent to a beautiful 2 or 3 year old, or whether that be in a professional context, then we need to develop the self-awareness to deal with whatever is blocking that flow.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's this extraordinary tale from Jewish mythology about this wild man, a mystic by the name of Samuel. And so some listeners will know this. And for the people who haven't heard this story before, it's this beautiful archetypal myth about a woman who couldn't have children and was gifted with a son miraculously. And so the deal that she made with the divine was to give this boy to the temple for a life of service. It's this really beautiful archetypal tale that you see popping up in all sorts of cultures and religions around the world. But this boy, he's 7. He's basically a janitor, and he represents the next wave, like a more in tune, connected kind of approach to life at this point in time. And he was the janitor, he's this kind of like servant boy about for a guy called Eli, who represented everything of the old guard, the old bureaucratic approach to it all. And Eli's this old cranky dude, and he's asleep, and it's kind of like a Harry Potter style tale where Samuel wakes up in the middle of the night because he's heard the voice of the divine. Now he thinks that it's Eli. And so he runs in to Eli, and he's like, hey, what do you need? And Eli is like, get out of my face, go back to bed. I'm trying to get some sleep. And so he's like, oh, he's confused, and he goes back to bed. And he does this on the second night, the exact same routine. He hears this voice, he gets up, and he runs into Eli, and he's like, what do you want me to do? And he's like, no, like, go back to bed. You're annoying me now. That's 2 days in a row. And the third night, the same thing. Now, Eli has just enough wherewithal to go, I understand what's happening. You're hearing the voice of the divine. Just go back and say, I'm listening. What do you need me to do? And I love this tale, right? And so whether it's like stories from Norse mythology or Jewish mythology or anywhere else, there's just these beautiful insights caught up in these things for us. And what I like most about this is that Samuel needed to learn to listen to the voices that were going on in his life. And the bigger tale here is learning how to listen. And what you and I are both talking about in the context of purpose could be applied to any context, as parenting, from a health perspective, from a how do I show up and like crush it at work, all of the things that are important to us really, really do just come down to, have we learned how to listen? Do we know how to discern between somebody else's voice and the more real voice? And are we prepared to say, okay, cool, I'm taking notice. What is it that you need me to do? And so regardless of who somebody is, and this is a practice that we help people with. Again, doesn't matter whether it's CEOs at an executive level or, you know, high performance, young people, emerging talent, blah, blah, blah. The skill is, how do you reflect? How do you check in? How do you learn to listen? And are you prepared to do something with what you're hearing?
So much power in that. And there's such a big difference between listening and hearing as well. But that would take me down a completely different rabbit hole. And today I want to talk about you. So to give you a little bit of context as to why I have called this podcast The DNA of Purpose, you know that I work very closely with the guys at Future Crunch, and I dare say that they have influenced me with a good dose of scientific thinking. And so I started to think about purpose through the lens of science. And what I discovered just in my own exploration was that how DNA behaved was actually quite similar, that I could draw similarities between my understanding of DNA and my understanding of what purpose is. So I want to, trial this way of thinking out on your life Phil Northworthy. So right. Let's start off with on how the DNA of purpose is inherited. You chose to study theology, and we've heard a little bit about that already today. As you were raised by Baptist pastors, what did you inherit from your family and in those early experiences that really inform the work that you do today?
Oh, it's wild. This feels like, Phil knows with you, this is your life.
It kind of is.
I like it. I mean, yes, you're right. I think there's generational inheritances, but I feel like it's a mixed bag, right? Mm-hmm. And I think most listeners would agree that there are things that I deeply love my parents. But I also had to get to a point in time where I owned my own ideas. And for me, that happened about the age of 25. And funnily enough, in a beautiful conversation with a mentor by the name of Colin James, somebody that you and I both know and Colin challenged me in the concept of ignorance. This was this beautiful, rolling 2.5 hours, like masterfully scaffolded session on ignorance that just took us deeper and deeper into, here's the things that you know, here's the things that you think you know, here's the things that you don't know about, but are still kind of audacious enough to talk about, and here are the things that you are just deeply ignorant of. And ignorance is this term that we throw about as though it's such a bad thing. But at a superficial level, ignorance is you don't know what you don't know. And what I found is that I, at the age of 25, was running on so many inherited ideas that I needed to like catch that process and bring them into a far more lucid set of choices and a selection criteria for myself. I had a wild reinvention of who I was at age 25. But you're right, I studied theology. And that's not strange for people to inherit the worldviews of their parents. Like the United Nations has done studies on this for the migration of ideas across borders. And they say that most people, 80% of people, will die in the dominant worldview of their parents. It means that, you know, like that old idea that the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. Mm. It just means that there are things that we inherit all the way back to your original question, which is like, what did I gain under the parenting of my beautiful parents, Stephen and Dawn Nosworthy, so much? Oh my God. Like a love and commitment for people. Yeah, shout out Stephen and Dawn. love and commitment to people. I think that's the number one, which is different worldview, different frame, but this ability to, over the very long term, continue to invest into the lives of people. Like I saw my parents do that from day dot. I think I was born in the second year of my dad's public ministry, if that makes sense. But then also understanding that a heart for people, quote unquote, it's kind of not enough. I mean, there are plenty of people who say that they care about people, but then it doesn't go very far. I mean, I used to be a part of a practice called Change Labs, which was acquired by EY. Shout out to all the lab rats and all the crew at EY. But we used to have this mantra that empty plates don't feed hungry bellies. So the idea was, say I was passionate about like poverty and hunger in the third world. And as a teenager, I would go on a hunger strike in my like privileged white Sydney household. I mean, it's lovely that I'm passionate, but a hunger strike's not going to help anybody in Africa. So this idea of empty plates don't feed hungry bellies. And so what I learned from my parents is that, yes, you can have a heart for people, but you got to back it up. And you got to back it up with structures. You got to back it up with action. You got to back it up with commitment. And those always find their place in community. And community isn't this loose thing. It's something that you can plan for. It's something that you can seed. It's something that you can invest into and needs support. So, oh my God, I've learned so much, right? So much. And outside of the stuff that I've soaked up from a personality and the way that I communicate and all of those kinds of things, I think some of the things that I'm most grateful for is just learning how to be invested into the lives of other people, not just this conceptual idea that it's good to be invested into the lives of other people.
Yeah, and I know one of the key areas you talk about in convergence is the gap between intention and action, which is exactly one of the things that you're talking about right now.
Yeah, it's a big one.
On the topic of Colin James, you might have already touched on the next section of this, which is that DNA evolves with the environment and that there are epigenetic factors with DNA. So you may have referenced this already, but what micro or macro environmental influences added fuel to the fire to the pursuit of not only your purpose, but your personal potential?
Yeah, huge questions. Holy smokes.
Like, I always
was coming
do
into this.
This
ready, but holy smokes, this is good. This is very exciting.
I love going there.
So micro or macro, right? Yeah, you talk about the master metaphor is gene expression and how, like, here's this underlying potential. So here's a beautiful story from told through the perspective of my parents. I remember in the lead up, it must have been like 1999 or something, like way late to the party for the Sydney Olympics. And my mum came and we were a pretty like sporty family. Like we had three boys. I'm the middle of three boys. And so the basic parenting strategy for raising boys is like, get them exhausted, feed them, because otherwise they're going to be trouble, right? And so we were always doing sport. But I remember my mum came into my bedroom one day, 1999, let's put it, and she said, let's get you to the Olympics. And I'm like, Mum, you're crazy. And she is. She's beautiful and bonkers. And she's like, whitewater rafting. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she said, well, this is the good news. I've done the research and there's only like four or five people in Australia that do it. So this is your best chance of going to the Olympics. You only have to beat four people.
Oh, Dawn believed in you.
And she's just a cracker, right? So so what she understood intuitively and what she taught me about that was this concept of like innate potential being contextualized. But if you're savvy enough to pick the right context, it will release opportunity for you. It'll be either really hard for you. It'll be really comparatively more rewarding. I remember, and again, just talking through the constructs of my folks, I remember Dad had a guest speaker for a men's retreat or something, you know, when I was young, and maybe I was only 12, and this guy was a mountain climber, just like your classic, I climbed a mountain talk, right? And I met him afterwards, and Dad was like, hey, some words of wisdom for my son. What do you reckon? What's one big insight for him? And this mountain climber said, all mountains are challenging to climb, but the view from the top of some is more worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I'm like 12. I'm like, literally, what the fuck are you talking about? And nowadays, though, I completely understand what he's talking about, which is to say that you've got to have skill to climb any mountain of significance, but climbing certain mountains is going to be so much more rewarding. And now in the context of work, everybody works hard, right? I just think that people work hard. Like I know kindergarten teachers who work harder than some CEOs that I know. And I know executive assistants that work harder than their directors. And I know directors who work harder than their team. People work hard, but you and I both know that certain lines of work is disproportionately rewarded. And so what people want to do is, yes, understand like the underlying potential in who they are, really tune into their sense of purpose, but then also be thoughtful in regards to how can I best direct this in ways that bring gratification, fulfillment to my soul, that allow me to pursue something over the long term, which we know is so much more rewarding than just kind of like, you know, 2 to 3 year career exits, you know, lurching forward. And how can I get rewarded for it financially? And so in that way, how can I become as valuable to as many people as possible by doing so? So, I mean, that's a big lesson. At risk of oversharing and over talking, we just kind of like grew up moving around different towns in different cities.
Yeah.
And so these different contexts made me very, very good at creating new friendships, very, very good at representing myself, putting myself out there. Mm. It became very fearless in new contexts. But if we're being really honest, which I think is always the best approach, what it also taught me is to move on from old friendships, maybe too fast. And so as a grown man now, 37, 38, I'm still coming to terms with this. It's not so much an imbalance, but like a real developed fearlessness in regards to going into new contexts, putting myself out there, creating new friendships, and bringing along everybody else in the past, because I learned probably as a self-protection strategy as a teenager that if we'd moved town or if we'd moved across the country again, that probably hurt too much.
Yeah, and you so had I've to hold that out.
I'm learning my way and unlearning my way through that one as well.
Yeah. So the third one is equally as big. So strap yourself in. But, you know, you spoke before about your two beautiful children, Xander and Odin, who having been on your Instagram profile, they are absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. Now, you have of course, passed on your DNA to them, literally. But what else? What is your legacy for your kids and for the next generation at large?
Oof. I'm so good brain. I have thoughts for this. Jess is my extraordinary wife. We got together when we were 17. And so the upside, and not making this like the holy grail of relationships, because it's unusual. And we know this. We know people who got together in high school and, you know, don't have the longevity that we have so far, is that we were able to spend more or less a lifetime together before our kids came along. And it gave us enough time to have these seasons of our life. And so that we felt ready for when kids came along. We were very, very conscious to understand that we didn't want to impose ourselves on our children. Now, this might rattle some cages, because I know that there are some people who are like, you know, instruct the children early so that they won't waver from the path over time. I couldn't think of anything more obnoxious. I mean, I'm 37. I haven't got life worked out. And I'm 37, English speaking, tall white guy from Sydney. You know what I mean? Like, I have a certain experience with life, and that has its edges, that has its parameters, it has its benefits, and it also has its with givings, the things that I don't understand.
But you see the lens of Phil Nolsworthy, yet the lens of the world is multidimensional. There's a thousand different ways. Yeah.
And I have to be so careful of confusing my preferences with truth.
Yeah.
And I think people have to continue to wrestle with that, which is like, this is how I think, but I think this because of my experiences, my circumstances, the opportunities and challenges that I've had. So when we raise our kids, I don't want to just go, here's how it is, as though I've got it all worked out. I mean, Gibran, in his book, The Prophet, which is this beautiful kind of like selection of poems. And it's the story of this kind of like village seer who's, you know, mystically moving on to the next place. And so he pulls together portions of the community group by group to give them last instructions. And to the parents, he says this: remember that your children come through you, but they are not yours.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I hold on to really, really dearly, which is it's fundamentally my role to keep my children safe, to protect them, yes, to feed their bodies, but not to like impose my stamp or my worldview on who they are, who they should be, the way that the world works. And so obviously I see that as a spectrum, is that it's going to be dominantly my worldview at the start, but as they progress, that to lead more and more through the lens of questions and inquiry and to help them along. And so, oh my God, I am so deeply invested into being a dad. It's like number one, right?
Oh, I mean, parenting, being lucky enough to be a parent is honestly one of the most incredible things in the world. And just the whole philosophy of you know, you have come through me, but not of me. I think it's almost like when this child comes through and every day you're meeting them again and meeting them again, because, you know, they do come through you, but they are not of you. They are unique, you know, and it's just this beautiful discovery.
Yeah, I think it's going to be different for, let's go, the royal we, our kids, this generation's kids. It's going to be different as well.
Yeah.
And this is not to speak ill of my parents, which it's not, but I don't recall my parents apologizing to me if they lost their temper or anything like that. It was a different era for parenting. And what I'm very keen on is showing my kids that I'm a human. And then I'm a work in progress. I think it was probably like 22 or 23 before I started seeing my folks as humans and not just parental units. And this extends, and I know this might be a bit much for some people, So take this one with a grain of salt. But Zan, who's 4 and a half, she'll call me Dad and Phil interchangeably.
Yeah.
You know, like half of the time it's like, hey, Phil. And I'm not really upset with that. I like her calling me Dad because it sounds nice and it like strokes my kind of like my ego dad drive.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice. The daddy's little girl part.
Yeah, but the fact that she sees me as Phil with hopes and fears and aspirations and dreams and foibles and... You know, if I, God forbid, I lose my temper, I'll go to her and say, hey, I lost my temper there. Can you come and help me find it? And we'll walk around the living room and we'll pick my temper back up and we'll put it in there.
So
and
cool.
I'll own that and I'll apologize in front of her so that she can see that I'm a work in progress. And I think that's going to be one of the big defining factors. That and the fact that our kids will just know us more because there's more videos, there's more photos of us. I mean, if I think about my folks at similar ages and stages than me, I mean, there's maybe 5 or 6 photographs. And so you go, what did you sound like? What did you move like? What did you actually think? And so I think our kids will know us more. Mm. So we shouldn't hide from that. We should embrace it and carefully and with wisdom, but show them more of who we are when they're ready for it.
Yeah, can I just say, I mean, I do a lot of interviews and get a lot of tips and tools and insights. That is by far one of the most liberating tips I've heard on parenting thus far on this podcast. So just to give yourself permission as a parent to be vulnerable, to not be perfect and just to do you and to know that that is as profoundly influential as anything else you could do by the rule book. So thank you for that one.
Mm. I think even more so. I mean, Zan will come to me and she'll be like, hey, I lost my temper or I misplaced. She'll say I misplaced my temper rather than I lost it. And then we'll go and look for it. And so I think, it's starting to rub off already. So that's lovely.
And it's actually teaching your children emotional intelligence, which, I dare say as we traverse into the future is going to be one of the most important tools that our children can have is the ability to feel, touch and know emotion.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I think it's the master key. I think everything after that is just linear learning. That's like kind of, Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours, Jeff Colvin, talent kind of stuff. It's like, if you're prepared to do the work, you'll get good at skills.
Yeah.
Emotional intelligence though, that's going to like keep chipping away at that.
Yeah.
That's the master key. Everything else after that is easy comparatively.
Mm. Mm. So, Phil, I'd love to take a deep dive into your professional purpose as a speaker and an educator and really a pioneer in the field of meaningful leadership and organisational change. Now, in hosting this podcast, I hear a lot of incredible stories about purpose-driven organisations, but I always have a few question marks around exactly what that means. And the reason for that is because I think that purpose is fundamentally human and it's so deeply personal. So I've always felt that it was a bit slapstick to say that an organization can even have a purpose in a sense.
Yeah.
So I have 2 questions here. How do you work with leaders in not only gaining clarity of purpose, but enabling an alignment between the personal purpose of the employee and the work of the organization?
That's a good question. I mean, if I was to kind of radiate out to our clients from the perspective of my own team first, we have our own mission statements, our own visions, our own understanding of purpose. But truth be told, like those things will get my team out of bed if I'm lucky, if we are lucky, 2 days out of every month. I mean, the stuff that's stuck up on the wall, be bold, be brave, be authentic. You know, like what are we about? We're about learning leadership and high performance, like all those things that we know how to say, that's going to get my crew juicy for 2 days out of the month. The thing that is going to really get them out of bed the other 28 days is their own purpose, their own reasons for working. Now, my role as a leader is to understand them intimately. And in fact, to help my team understand theirs intimately, because sometimes people come in and of course, all things work like this. We grow and we evolve and we mature over time, but they've got like a nascent, like a kernel of an idea in regards to what work means for them and why. So my work as a leader in the lens of purpose for my own team is to help them crystallize their sense of purpose and be able to answer the question, why do you go to work?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't, for me, it doesn't matter what it is. What matters is, do they know it? Because, you know, not from a Machiavellian perspective, but from a leadership perspective, if I can understand that and I can position and present working life in a way that enables them to get that, then they'll want to keep showing up and they'll want to keep putting in. The second that there's not a line of sight or there's no connection between who they really want to be, what they really want for their life, and how they're using those 8 or 9 hours a day, I've lost my ability to ask them to do anything. And so I'm with you. I'm really intent on the idea that organizations do have purpose and they can have purpose, but those things are subservient to the individual purposes and drives of the people that work in those organizations. When the collective set of purposes align to the labels, the stickers, the posters, the logo on the door, then you've got a chance of being a purposeful organization. Mm. The fact that you've hired an ad agency to pick 3 or 5 words out of the sky that say, we are this, this, and this. I mean, it doesn't make you a purposeful or a purpose-led organization. Mm. It just sounds like, for a lot of organizations, more of a tick-the-box activity.
Well, yeah, and I've always kind of thought, let's call it what it is, which is a return on impact. And that's an amazing thing. I do believe any business should be out there doing good where they can, but at least this is only my point of view, but I'm like, let's call it what it is, because if you want to be a purpose-driven organization, let's start with HR over CSR.
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting view. I mean, so Satya Nadella, CEO of one of our great clients, Microsoft, he has very specifically said, we want you to see Microsoft as a platform for your existence, for your career, for your skills, for a place that you can come and make yourself and find yourself. And increasingly over time, Microsoft is willing to make decisions about the longevity, the opportunity for people to contribute to that ecosystem based on alignment between who the greater whole sees themselves to be and the individual perspectives of people. And so I love that. I love the fact that, yes, Microsoft has its grand vision, which is to empower organizations and people to do more. Now, that's about as elevated and as high and abstract of a purpose that you could define for an organization. But it's Microsoft. I mean, if Microsoft disappeared at midnight tonight, satellites would fall out of the sky, banks would collapse, superannuation would disappear.
We'd notice that.
So when they say, what do we exist to do is to empower people to do more, then that's accurate. So for people who come and work there, they've got to be able to find themselves in that purpose. Now, if they don't care about empowering people, if they don't care about people, if they don't care about more, don't work there. And so the idea is, yes, an organization has purpose, but it's kind of like what you were talking about before. It's the kernel, it's a potential, it's almost aspirational. And the thing that makes it real is the humans within the buildings, or now within that operate life underneath the logo on the banner.
So, Phil, this is such an obvious thing to say, but it goes without saying that the world in 2021 is vastly different to the one that existed only 2 years ago, let alone a decade ago. We're living in an age of political change, socioeconomic change, and, of course, environmental change. Can you talk me through why you think at this particular point in human history we need to approach human potential through a new lens, and what does that lens look like?
Yeah, I do. I think the last 40 or 50 years is proof enough that talent isn't enough. We've done such a good job of educating people. Now we've got a long way to go, and I'm not suggesting that education is equally distributed, but gosh, if you go backwards in time, like 100 years, literacy rates were through the floor. Like people, we had children working in factories. We've done a good job collectively of elevating more people than we had up until that point. And we kind of took that idea to its logical extension, which is, if we can just make people smart enough, then everything will work out. And we are qualified through the roof. Like, people know more stuff. And again, you know, just being careful and putting these statements into the conversation just to be respectful and honest is, we know that this is not equally distributed. But for a lot of people listening in here, you have more than enough. You know enough. In fact, you know more than any other generation that has ever existed. And as cliched as it sounds, that's extraordinary. This idea that we kind of have all fallen for is that knowledge is power, which was a real kind of like, it came through in the 70s. And I think it is still true in certain circumstances. But in the context of work, knowledge isn't power. Knowledge is potential. Because I know a bunch of people who are smart enough but don't have confidence, or what you and I would describe as confidence. They don't have the ability to get their ideas out of their heads into the minds of other people. They don't have enough of a self construct in order to really show up and bring the fullness of all of that knowledge that they have spent so much time putting into their heads. And so this approach to talent that is necessary going into the future has to be far more holistic than we've ever conceptualized it in the past, which is, yeah, talent is really, really cool. But what about these other bits? Now, on your side of the world, I think Tane and Angus, shout out Future Crunch, articulate this just as well as anybody else ever could, which is that sequentially we've moved through different eras. There was this era of IQ. If people were smart enough, it'll all work out. But inevitably, you know that there are eras in business ideology and thinking, you know, and so we had like Drucker, and it was all about excellence. And just here's, you can systematize all this stuff. And then we're like, oh, it may be a little bit. And then we got into like the late 90s, where you had Marcus Buckingham say, well, first things first, go work your strengths, because it's not just about doing everything with excellence. You got to work out what you can do better than anybody else and go do that thing. And then we worked out that you can actually over oscillate to a strength so much that the industry will move underneath you, and you have like, you've reduced your impact or your longevity in the marketplace. So Brené Brown comes along and just changes the game by saying, actually, you've got to be put together as a human. So we've seen these movements, and they roughly map to the IQ stage of the workplace, the EQ stage of the workplace. And now what's happened? You know, .com, like, we've got enough experience now. .com changes things. Pandemic has changed things. Marketplaces collapse. You got like businesses being Ubered, you know, without sounding too gross or cliched, rise of new industries and all of these kinds of things. And people are like, oh my God, I could be super smart. I could be super nice. But unless I'm able to change and adapt and evolve and be led by that thing that we used to call intuition, then again, it's going to be shaky underfoot. So we are in this era that I just call skill and substance. It is this idea of deep skill, deep mastery of the things that matter most to you, combined with and amplified by the substance of who you are, which people can populate that however they want. But for me, substance means grit. It means soulfulness. It means commitment. It means personal discipline. It means faithfulness to my team. It means the good stuff. It's the good stuff.
Yeah, we've almost got a fusion between intellectual depth and intuitive intelligence playing out at the same time. So, Phil, I want to talk about convergence, because I think convergence actually provides a solution to some of what we've just discussed. And the way I took the concept of convergence, which is your lead keynote topic at this point in time, was that we have old paradigms of thinking in a world that requires new solutions to solve new problems, and that there is fundamentally a gap there. You know, when you consider how we are handling the ethics of emerging technologies, social and political reform, the environment, or even the management of a global pandemic, how can convergence help leaders to catalyze positive influence in the world at a time where we need it more than ever?
Yeah, convergence is the name that we've given to a daily framework for self-reflection. We call it performative self-reflection because the difference between you know, navel gazing and thinking about how I'm showing up to life so that tomorrow I might show up a little bit more refined, a little bit more soulful, a little bit more true to who I plan to be is quite distinct. And so this is not self-reflection for self-flagellation. This is constant improvement and doing the work, what I would call the work, capital T, capital W. Because I'm convinced, and this has been my experience with the CEOs and the really wonderful artists and entrepreneurs and athletes that we've worked with over the years, that if you do the work, other things follow. Is that the work is the lead and the linchpin for some of the stuff that you actually think that you want to work on, but they fall into line in a far neater way that if you're prepared to think about who you are and how you're showing up to life. So there's five convergences, and really what they're designed to do is teach people to listen. And this loops us back into that story that we told before, that myth of learning how to listen and learn to discern between the voices that are at play in our own world, whether it's the voice of the marketplace, whether it's the voice of the expectations of our parents now that we're adults, whether it's the voice of our own household and the coulds and the shoulds, versus that true voice that calls us into purpose and impact every single day. And so there's five, and really they are about bringing these two things together. So it's not one over the other, but it's about like what happens when you bring these factors together in really powerful and potent ways. And for me to set this up, the best way to articulate this or to describe this is the fact that people have the raw ingredients that they need. Very rarely have we ever worked with and found somebody just utterly lacking in something that they need to succeed in their journey on life, because that doesn't make sense. I mean, that is not my experience. In what is more true is that people have the ingredients, but they haven't put them into play or they haven't used them in the way that is necessary. So it's kind of like baking a cake, right? And that's the master metaphor, is that you can make a cake with flour, milk, sugar, and eggs. That's basically all you need. But if you've got flour on the bench, if you're scrambling eggs, if you're drinking the milk, if you're throwing the sugar over your shoulder, you might have all the ingredients you need, but that's not going to produce a cake for you. You've got to put them together in the right way. So we've talked about skill and substance, you know, the fact that our character either amplifies or nullifies our skill. And then you referenced before this beautiful convergence of intention and action. And that's to know that there can be a gap between what we want to do, what we plan to do, what we mean to do, and what we actually do. And so the kick in this idea is that the size of the gap between my intentions and my actions is the size of the dysfunction in that area of my life. And that also equates to the size of the growth opportunity. So if I'm clear on who I want to be, plan to be, mean to be, then presumably my number one work in each day is to just live into that before I try and put into practice stuff that I don't yet know, which brings us to the third convergence, which is the convergence between knowledge and application. And this is as true a statement as people will hear today, is that we have become addicted to new insights. We're all convinced that our next growth and our next leap forward is going to come out of something that we've never heard before or we've never read before. And that's why I think we're just gluttons for new knowledge. Now, I love learning just about more than most people that I've met. I love it. I really love it. But I'm actually far more intent in putting into practice the things that I know, rather than falling for this myth, this illusion that if I just keep learning stuff, then that'll take care of itself. This idea that knowledge is potential, but application is power. And then, you know,
which is often the gap between the academic world and the working world, right?
Look, it can be. It can be. I mean, you could know all these things, and it's kind of like, we just know people. I know people who are CEOs who have done the long stints at INSEAD in Paris. They've done the long weekends at Stanford and Harvard. They're 30 years in the game as a leader of people, but they just leave trails of human destruction behind them. It's not about how much you know about leadership. It's about what you do with what you know. And so you will come across leaders who really know one or two things, but my God, they are savage in the way that they put that into practice every single day of their life. And I would genuinely, I would prefer to know less and leverage it more than to be the smartest person in the room and just be a walking basket case for application. People always like these dumb internet ideas, like you got to be the hardest working person in the room. Oh my gosh, that's a dumb idea.
Yeah.
Because there'll always be somebody who wants to like burn more midnight hours than me. And I like sleep and rest and time with my family. Mm. And that the idea of like being the smartest person in the room, first of all, it's infused with ego and vanity. Secondly, like, what does it even mean? Mm. What does it mean to be the smartest person? Does it mean that you know more, or does it mean that you're willing to listen and be just an animal for productivity and getting cool things done at the right time? So fourth and fifth convergences, identity and reputation. Identity is who we think we are, who we see ourselves to be, which is sometimes shaky, sometimes changes from day to day, sometimes there's a work in progress. But the problem is if I think that I am something and the people that matter to me, my team or my marketplace, think something different, then potentially that's dangerous.
Yeah.
We all know leaders who think they're pretty impressive, but they're not. They're just kind of like buying tickets to their own show. So we need to kind of converge who we think we are with who they say we are.
Yeah.
And then the final one, which is a killer, 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 killer point, which is the convergence between confidence and courage. And I think in the most part, confidence is overrated. But unfortunately, everybody tells you, you just need to be more confident. It's just not possible. Mm. Like I have done this my entire life, literally. And I still get nervous every single time I talk. So yeah. If I optimize my life around confidence, I wouldn't have what I have and I wouldn't do what I do.
Yeah.
So
in the times where confidence comes from repetition, where actually most of the time in leadership, you're being pushed outside of your comfort zone and you can't be confident in that. You know, you're leaning into risk and uncertainty and vulnerability, which is where courage comes in.
Big facts, big facts. I mean, yes, you're exactly right. Confidence comes through repetition. And so that's why, like, you know, so shout out to all the parents and your teenage children and you say, you just need more confidence. How could they? Because they're doing this stuff for the first time. And if you're like in sales or a sales director and you're telling your team, you just need more confidence, but you've also asked them to like do new things, trial new products, the marketplace has changed, the way that people are buying and consuming is different. No one has the space or capacity to repeat their way to excellence anymore. So confidence isn't the primary currency of growth. Courage is. And courage is by definition, this acknowledgement of this makes me feel uncomfortable, but I'm going to give it a shot. And that's the thing. So that's, yeah, in a lot of ways, they are cornerstones to the philosophies that we teach. Really soulful, high-performing people around the world.
So, Phil, I was watching your showreel on convergence and you said something that stood out for me. You also said not to quote you on it if there were journalists in the room.
Oh, dear.
But the words that you said was the automation of dysfunction is due to a lack of purpose. And that really got me thinking about why we automate dysfunction in the first place.
Yeah.
And this is maybe swinging into a bit of Jungian psychology, but what I really got from your message was that in some part we act from an unconscious place in leadership. So we step into the automation of dysfunction and it's in the shadow. We're not even aware that we need to become more conscious or that we need to wake up. So in the context of leadership, what perpetuates that dysfunction or that unconscious action, and what does it actually take to wake up, to become consciously aware when we might not even be aware of the dysfunction in the first place? Sorry, I know that's a complex question, but
that's a good question.
I was pondering it.
That's a really good question. And I think if I was being honest to what I really want to say, you know, and Ryan Holiday has coached me recently, you've got to write what you think you can't write and you've got to say what you think you can't say. So this is what I'm going to say is that you cannot force an awakening in your own life. You cannot decide to do that for yourself. So the idea of maturing, evolving, that happens at the right time. You know, Ram Dass would say, you can't peel the skin from a snake before its time. I mean, when it's time, it's time. And you'll become something else and something new. What I do believe, though, is that you can do the groundwork.
Yeah.
And you can act on the things that you know to act on. So if Maya Angelou says, back then you did what you knew to do, but now that you know better, you'll do better.
Hmm.
The inference here is that there's power in self-reflection and noticing what's going on in our own lives. And the more aware I am of the patterns at play in my life, the more choice I have in regards to who I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, if I can hold that in view for long enough, there's a really beautiful chance that I will actually become that thing, because it's impossible to see something that is impossible for us to become, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, well, we can't even see it if it's not possible for us. It'll remain a blind spot. And so that's the good news, is that if we are seeing something at work in the lives of anybody else, if we can see it,
mm.
you go, wow, look at them. They're in flow. Look at them. That's inspirational. Look at the way that they communicate. If you can even see it, you stand a really good chance of being able to replicate that into your own life.
Mm, find it in yourself. Yeah.
But this idea of like being unconsciously driven, yeah, there's not a lot we can do about that. I think that's the truth of the life work of Carl Jung, is that there's always going to be unconscious drivers in our life. And the second that you can uncover some of those things through deep work, and for people, whether that's like keeping a track of their dreams, whether that is doing some automatic writing, whether that is just through brute self-reflection every single day, any patterns that we surface, they become visible. But it doesn't mean that we eliminate things that are invisible or things that are unconscious in our life. So the encouragement is to look deeper.
Mm.
The encouragement is to never get to the bottom of things, because good luck with that. You'll need a little bit more time, but that's not a dire warning. That is not a discouragement, because my goodness, there's work to be done. And it's actually super exciting, because as deep as we would like to explore, there are opportunities for us to grow. And the opportunity to evolve is limitless. Certainly, I mean, I haven't met a 75-year-old, regardless of how remarkable those people are, who has ever said, I'm done, I'm finished, I've reached the pinnacle of human existence. There's always work to be done. And personally, I find that actually just very satisfying, because playing with the time scale and the sequence and the size of things actually gives me more grace and space. It doesn't freak me out. It just makes me go, okay, cool. Well, I'll just work on the thing that's in front of me. And then I'll get to the next thing after that.
All part of the journey. And I mean, I've always, having, as you know, worked with speakers for a long time in working with people, said, you know, if you want to stand on the stage in a big spotlight, then you need to acknowledge that there is always a shadow. And sometimes the bigger the light, the bigger the shadow. And that's just a part of stepping into leadership and a part of stepping into influence of any kind.
Yeah, I agree. I think for anybody that is kind of like new in their journey into shadow work, it just basically means that there's parts of our psyche. The shadow is typically the part of our psyche that we're not prepared to look at. Jung would encourage us to not be freaked out by anything that is us, because it's us. And what is there to worry about something that's on the inside of me? Now, easier said than done, because of course there's things that kind of freak us out about ourselves. And if we're doing it right, there always will be. But to understand from Carl Jung's work that, you know, we are unified, but individually, I mean, there's all sorts of drives and aspects to who we are. And a good shorthand is the king, warrior, magician, lover archetype, or for women, the queen, warrior, magician, lover. And for me, this is something that's tattooed on me, which is these kind of like four cornerstones of like who we are, like the four functions and almost the four identities that sit within us. Now, if this is new terminology to people, I would encourage, don't let it freak you out. It's just a way of thinking about yourself.
And
for me as a guy, like king, warrior, magician, lover, the king's role is to bring, stability and generosity to the kingdom, right? And so that what that means is like I've got to organize my life. I've got to work in a decision-making capacity. But then there's a part of me that is the warrior that just wants to go out and kick ass, that wants to like get good things done, make plans and conquer and win. And then there's the magician that creates things that never were. Like it's the entrepreneurial aspect of life. And then the lover is the part of us that indulges and enjoys. Mm. But the shadow of each is really dangerous. I mean, like there's tyrant kings and there's and tyrant queens. But speaking from the masculine for myself, and there's like warriors that are out of control. And there are magicians who like learn things just to take advantage of other people. And there's selfish lovers. And so this idea is, how do I understand myself? How do I understand some of the more unconscious drivers of what makes me tick? And the good news is that a minute invested into understanding who you are is never wasted. The more we understand ourselves, the more space we have, the more potential we have, and the more power we have in showing up to do the things that we think we're here for.
Mm. So, Phil, I'm at my last question today, and it's a simple one on the end of all of that. Is there anything over the course of this podcast that you have left unsaid that you feel is truly significant to share with our listeners?
Oh, there's a lifetime of things unsaid. And especially for somebody who uses words as a primary tool for getting things done. I think we just have to like listen to the moment. And at the moment, I feel like we've covered some pretty heady ground.
We have.
I think the primary the primary encouragement is always to just check in. What matters? What matters now? What is this about? A great mutual friend of ours, Dan Flynn, CEO, managing director, co-founder of Thank You. When Zan, this is way back, maybe 5 years ago, when Zan was coming along and arriving for the first time, he said, hey, you make sure that, you know, now that you're a dad, that you do what only you can do. And I thought he was talking about delegation, right? Because Dan's a great leader.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, you Muppet. This is not about delegation. This is about doing what only you can do, which is you're the only person who can be dad to your daughter to be. You're the only person who can be husband to your wife. So as long as you're in those roles, do those things and don't neglect those things. And I think that's a beautiful approach to life, to impact, to leadership, which is really check in. What are the things that are yours to do?
Mm.
And whatever you do, make sure that you do those things. Other things can wait because presumably they're not even yours to do anyway.
Yeah. And what a beautiful way to end a podcast called The DNA of Purpose, I have to say. Phil, where can we visit you online? You have so many incredible resources. I downloaded a PDF on meaning making and there's 1,001 podcasts out there. But, you know, where can we visit you? Where can we find your work?
I'm the only Phil Nosworthy that I'm aware of out on the internet. So Phil with two L's. If you just put me into Google or Bing or Yahoo, whatever your preferred search engine is, you'll find a truckload of things, whether it's videos or whether it's resources. I also want to encourage anybody that's listening. I am a normal person. And so for anything that I could ever do for people, just drop me a note. It's easy enough to find my email as well. So yeah, that's a good place.
As always, such a joy to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, what a joy. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the podcast. If you'd like to follow along, please do at the DNA of Purpose on Instagram. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is the DNA of Purpose with Rebecca Tapp. And if you'd like to keep up to date with all of our team's news and events, you can jump onto my website, which is rebeccatapp.com. That is rebeccatapp with two P's.com. Also, if you love what we do, then please do leave us a review. It would be greatly appreciated. Or if you'd like to share your inspiration with our team, we'd love to hear from you. Please do reach out, say hi at your favorite social media hangout.